I first met Hugh Cook when he was at the end of high school after he made a very serious suicide attempt. Only through a series of miraculous events is he alive. Over the course of his healing journey, he actually decided to become a psychotherapist. He's a very interesting fellow, extremely empathic, very sensitive, and very bright. So I want to welcome Hugh. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Today, I'd like to introduce a fellow that I met 7 or 8, 9 years ago when he was in high school, probably at the lowest point in his life. And now he's on the podcast to talk about what it's like to get to a place where now he's training to become a therapist, which I think is amazing because when I was working with him in my practice, probably one of the most empathic, intelligent, capable people I'd ever met. And so he reached out to me recently to just to ask me about a counseling center in town. I thought, oh, I got to get this guy on my podcast. So Hugh Cook has graciously been willing to appear here. So welcome, Hugh.
Thank you.
And what I'd love for you to do is to start off by just giving us an idea about who you are and then to start sort of early in your life and go from there.
Awesome. Yeah. My name is Hugh Cook and I grew up here in Santa Barbara. I like surfing. I like hiking. I love nature. And I really enjoy reading sci-fi, fantasy, mythology. I'm on the way to becoming a therapist. I went to UCSB had a writing and literature major. And now I work for a program called Gauchos for Recovery, which is here in town, UCSB's collegiate recovery program. And I'm going to Pacifica Graduate Institute to become an LMFT.
Cool. We don't necessarily have to start at the beginning of your life. You can start with when I met you and describe a bit of what happened. And if it's okay, I'll fill in some of the blanks.
Sounds good. Yeah. So when I met Dana, I had just gotten out of, basically a children's psychiatric hospital called Vista Del Mar, because I had, attempted to take my own life, by overdosing on a bunch of medications, not just like drugs, you know, and I was very depressed at that point. It's funny because my life is so different now. It's almost, you know, it's something that I don't think about as often, but it was such a intense time. I remember it was very much this gray world, and I was quite hopeless, I think, at the time. And I was trying to see therapists on getting out, and I saw somebody who was really CBT focused, and they wrote some affirmations for me to say, and I didn't really feel like I got it. And I saw somebody who was really sweet, but like the intake just was this sheet, and they were asking me these questions and checking off boxes. And then Dana, when I met you, it was so different because it felt like we were just sitting in a room together, and that really struck me. So definitely something I try to bring into my own world.
Well, you're very kind. I remember the first time I met you, you were quite disappointed that you survived the suicide attempt. I remember that, you know, seeing this very sad, really angry young man, felt incredibly touched by how much pain that you were in, obviously. Usually when I meet someone who's in that kind of despair, in order for me to work with you, I had to ask you if you would consider not attempting suicide again for 6 months. I don't know if you remember that, but I asked you to give me 6 months.
Yeah. So that's good to hear the specification of it, because what I remember, how I think it felt to me was like, it felt like you were saying to me, give me a shot, basically.
Right.
And like, let me try to see if I can help you. And that was really important to me because it was a person, you know, it was you saying, I'll walk through this with you, you know, and kind of be in this place with you. And and I also think it felt good to have that kind of rule about like, give it time, because the hopelessness I felt didn't feel willing to wait. And so it was really helpful to have kind of that outside invitation to take time.
Right. Well, I could tell from meeting you that if you made a promise that you would keep it because you were that kind of a person, even though it was probably not your first choice. I'm sorry to laugh, but I just remember you looking at me like, oh, fuck, I don't want to do that. But, you know, I think I explained to you that in order for me to feel comfortable working with you, I didn't want to worry in the back of my mind that you might try to take your life again. And I only asked for 6 months because I figured that if I can't help you get moving within that period of time, then, you know, I can't stop you from...
Yeah.
Nobody can stop you from taking your own life, but I guess I needed a commitment from you in order to see if I could help you at least get to a place where life might be worth living and then beginning a really healing process.
Yeah. I'm just struck by how human that offer is and how, like, just, you know, I'm only in the beginning of my journey to become a therapist, but it is, you know, it could be a very frightening position to be in for the therapist. And So just that idea of like, give me a chance. But I also remember you saying to me, if I can share this, if you are suffering forever, I would not make you promise to keep living.
Right.
And you weren't afraid of that life could be hard and depression could be real. And I think you probably knew that that wouldn't be my forever. And so,
well, but, I was hoping, certainly. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I wish I could predict the future.
Yeah.
But I do have a lot of faith in the process. My philosophy, again, is not to pathologize you and not to agree with you that there's something wrong with you because you were already feeling bad about yourself. So why would I agree with your assessment of yourself when that's not the way I experienced you as a person?
Yeah.
So I do appreciate that compliment. And but I also think that because of the circumstances that kept you alive, because of my spiritual sort of orientation, it's not an accident that you're still here.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to describe what happened, or you'd like me to, but however you want to do it, I think it's an amazing story.
No, yeah, I'll share a little bit about it. I just remember that day I left school. I stayed till the end of the day at school because I don't think I knew what I wanted. I thought about leaving at lunchtime, but then I didn't do it because my friend came to talk to me, and I ended up connecting with them a little bit. But after school, I think, on my own, I started cycling, and those thoughts came up about suicide. And so I had like a stash box of drugs, basically, which we'll probably talk more about drugs later. But I had a stash box of drugs at the time, and I drove up into the mountains to this abandoned trail I had found. And, you know, it was really exciting. A couple weeks before this attempt, I had found that trail, and it was misty out, and I was exploring nature, and I felt like youthful energy and kind of got out of that depression in a way that I really wasn't at that point in time. And so, yeah, so then I went up to this trail and I was like, I'll die here. And that will feel like a reconnecting with that excitement in a way. But, what ended up happening was that while I overdosed down the trail, or like tried to overdose down the trail, I must have like in a blackout kind of stumbled out of that trail onto the road. And then I still could have died there, but two women who were driving up to this place called Lizard's Mouth happened to find me, and they called 911 and probably did save my life. The attempt did have some lethality to it. It wasn't sort of it had lethal capacity to it. So they probably did save my life.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my understanding at the time is that these women lived in the San Ynez Valley, and just randomly one said to the other, hey, you ever been to Lizard's Mouth?
Yeah.
And the other lady said, well, I don't even know what that is. And she said, well, I want to show it to you. And these are not necessarily people that you would expect to go hiking in nature. And the fact that they found you and saved your life, in my mind, was, you know, nothing short of a miracle, because according to the reports that I read, you were on your way to dying for sure. It was not a minor attempt.
Okay.
It was really serious.
Yeah.
So, and then I remember how mad that you were, because you were quite a determined fellow when you set your mind to something. You know, thank God now you're setting your mind to something that's really going to be of service to others. But at that time, I know that you were in a very, very low place.
Yeah.
So we started working together, and I'm hoping that part of what you discovered that helped you was how empathic and sensitive you are as a person.
Yeah.
Because it sure seemed to me that you had spent your whole life carrying your mother and father and brother's pain inside your body. And no matter how hard you tried, you could not save them from their own despair and pain. which is a really common thing for a sensitive person.
I do think I am extremely sensitive and empathic and that I pick up these energies relatively easily. I'm sure as a kid that I spent a lot of time wanting to care for my parents and my brother and kind of, you know, a big part of my process of coming to terms with that was looking at like what was my role in this sort of thing. And like, I know that's, you know, as a child, we really don't have that much control over the systems that we're in. But a big piece of my journey to become an adult has been, what do I do with this empathic sense? And how do I like start to take care of myself rather than other people? And like,
right,
ultimately having the energy to choose that. But I definitely think that the caring for others felt like this way to almost feel in control, maybe to a certain extent, to feel that safety or power or whatever I felt like I was able to get from having that sense of other people. Maybe.
Do you remember as a little kid sort of feeling the tension in the family that wasn't being acknowledged?
I mean, it may have been that. I remember how anxious I was. I remember at times in my family that tension kind of bursting out and things like that in different ways. But I really remember as a child just times of feeling anxiety.
Right.
And I don't know, I could at the time like notice if it was systemic or rather than just mine.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I mean, part of what I came to understand in getting to know you and actually getting to meet your parents and working with them a bit was that their orientation toward life was not of a psychological nature. They're very intellectually bright, capable people. Your mom being a professor at the university and your dad also working there. And so they really did not understand what you were going through at all.
Yeah.
It was a huge mystery to them. And I was kind of shocked because they're very well educated people, but it just was not their orientation to consider, how their children were feeling, especially you.
Yeah.
But I do remember once they started to understand your capacity for sort of divining people's reality, they were stunned and really blown away at how much that you were, how aware you were of whatever the problems might have been in the family and so on and so forth. And so fortunately, they got on board with all of that instead of telling you that, you know, that you're crazy and all this stuff is made up, which sadly sometimes happens in these situations.
Yeah.
So you and I worked together for a while, and then I stopped seeing you. I know that you struggled with substances also, and that was a part of where we kind of lost contact. What can you tell us a bit about what that struggle was like and what happened?
Definitely. And I mean, I'll go all the way back to say, like, it's funny that you mentioned I'm somebody who keeps my word, because as I don't think that as a young man I was that person, but now I do feel that I have become that person, which is good. I would say that I remember in high school, like in my sophomore year, the first time I ever drank completely blacked out. Like as soon as I had a drink, I was like, oh my God, I only have to be the best parts of myself. Perfect. That's what I want. And so just like blacking out and completely embarrassing myself, puking on the bathroom floor, peeing in a trash can, the whole thing. And then waking up and be like that, so deeply ashamed of who I was and afraid of getting in trouble. And then going home and feeling like shit. And then immediately wanting to do it again after that.
Right.
And so for a couple of years, that was kind of what I was interested in on the weekends. And, you know, I would say even then, drinking kind of made me want to just drink and not run cross country or whatever, you know, sort of these alternate ways of feeling good. And eventually, as school started to intensify and I thought about who's going to accept me to college and things like that, I started to withdraw and isolate myself, which was something I had done more in eighth grade. But it sort of came back a little bit stronger towards the end of my sophomore year and my junior year. And I would buy Adderall and Valium, and it originally was just like, before I even tried to commit suicide, it was like I bought it a couple times every 2 weeks or so I would take it, and you know, oh, there's a test or something like that, and you know, but certainly substance misuse or whatever. And I actually think at the time, like, that wasn't something that I was talking about with you, and if I had been talking about it, my pathway could have been different.
Right.
But, you know, that's pretty classic with substance use disorder, is to be hiding it, denial, lying, you know, all of these things. And so anyway, I think that probably intensified my depression and maybe increased some of the mood swings and could have increased the suicidality. And Then when I got out of the hospital, I went to see the psychiatrist and I told him that I really liked basically benzodiazepines. And I was prescribed those and some sleeping pills eventually, kind of working the system and like telling him that I wanted these narcotics. And kind of, I was probably lying about what I was experiencing depression-wise or, you know, sleep problem-wise or anxiety-wise to get these medications. And, you know, definitely ended up shooting myself in the foot in a way with that. But I think that at the time, I just couldn't see past, first of all, some of my own, you know, some of my own, like a little bit of narcissism, honestly, and then also some real suffering, a combination of the two. Yeah, that kind of kept me in its grip. Benzodiazepines were, I ended up getting pretty fucking addicted to them. Sorry to swear, but it was not good for many years. And, you know, periods of time working with you where we would touch briefly on like, you know, I would kind of go through these cycles of like, oh, I don't like these drugs. They're numbing me. And, but I was never willing yet to kind of give them up. You know, eventually after working on some other stuff with you, I don't know how it works. You probably know more about this than me, but I'm imagining that eventually we got enough of the deep stuff out of the way that I was ready to get sober. And so simultaneously, while you and I were hopefully doing some good work that I don't know enough about this, you know, enough about therapy yet to understand it, my addiction was also getting really deep. I was buying drugs off the street and I had, you know, I was doing cocaine and other things and stuff like that. And just, it was really bad. And I don't think I was depressed by that point, thanks to a really intelligent psychiatrist who's also been on the show. And just, you know, quite lucky in that way, but certainly still deeply in a substance use disorder. And, you know, I ended up having conversations with you about like, okay, I think I need to get more treatment. And I don't think at the time I was able to call it that I needed treatment for, you know, an addiction, but it was definitely that. And I ended up going to do that and leaving Santa Barbara and going to this place in Arizona and then this place in LA to get like group therapy and like, you know, partial. Well, I went to an inpatient treatment center and do the withdrawals. They didn't give me a taper at first. I don't know if I probably did tell you this like right after, but they didn't give me a taper at first. And it was like hell-ish to feel that in my body. And I think that helped me kind of establish my sobriety and my recovery to be able to remember how much pain I had put myself in through these substances. And so, yeah, now now I'm in recovery and I work for a recovery program and things like that. And, you know, so it's very much become a part of my life, but that's kind of the substance use journey.
So after you left the substance treatment program in Los Angeles, you and I lost touch. I think, yeah. Did you go to Hawaii or somewhere? I can't remember, actually.
I did eventually. Yeah. So I kind of realized like I need to take responsibility for some of these, I think as a teenager, pieces of myself that I hadn't been able to take responsibility for. And so I really tried to focus on that. But I also had a lot of adventures. I went to a cranberry farm and sorted cranberries for a month and was very much in like my nature, you know, farm rural self that felt really good. And I did go to Hawaii and I lived in an intentional living community with some people who were on a very interesting pathway and were exploring, like some of them had been polyamorous and I became interested in that. And they were sitting with ayahuasca. I don't do that because my recovery personally doesn't include like psychedelics or anything like that. But it was a fascinating world full of rich new things and embodiment and being like it, you know, swimming at nude beaches and just adventures and still learning about myself and the areas where I had growth to do, but in a really tight-knit community. And, you know, I've become interested in rituals of initiation. And I think that was kind of a secondary one after the 12 steps. It was like these two initiations. So,
and how long were you in that situation?
I was in Hawaii for about 6 months before I decided to finish my degree at UCSB because I took time off school when I got sober. So.
Oh, okay. So then you came back to Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
And have been here ever since?
Yeah, I've been here since fall 2022, I want to say. Is that might be 1 year off. Anyway, a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Okay. So when in your healing journey did you decide that it might be a wise choice to become a therapist yourself?
Yeah, good question. You know, honestly, something that was stopping me from coming back to school was that I just didn't feel in touch with poetry anymore. I remember when I was working with you, I published this like ebook of poetry, and it felt like this huge victory and like, oh, I'm really going to be this amazing poet. And I think I was really looking for this, like, you know, a lot of external validation. And I'm laughing now because like poetry is probably not the thing to lead to a lot of external validation in this world. But at the time I was like, I'll be Rilke, you know, and it felt empty. And I think I was kind of coming up against, again, this need at the end of the day to be of service, because I won't feel the best. I won't feel as good as I can feel each day doing things that try to validate me externally.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but what does it mean to you to be of service? How would you define that?
Good question. I mean, that's a phrase that I learned in recovery. I think it means really anything that I'm doing for somebody else, and the selfish gain, you know, selfish gain is that you get to not think about yourself, right? Because so much of the recovery concept is like my problems come from thinking, hyper-focusing on myself.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, it is like what feels best to me in this world is to be altruistically dedicated to another.
Okay.
And so therapy felt like a good place to do that. And it's also a good way to, I'm relatively extroverted. I like talking to people. I like getting to know people. I like deep, meaningful, true conversations rather than worrying about numbers, you know, for example. Right. I have a lot of people, including, you know, you, who have helped me come to this place. And so those are the people who I've always admired in the world. And I think I want to build myself a life that includes that.
And how are your parents about this choice for you?
I mean, my parents have, you know, changed so much since my suicide attempt. Honestly, that was like this breaking open, I think, for the whole family. But
how would you describe their change?
I mean, they've been to family therapy with me. They've done work on themselves. I would say my dad quit his job, and I remember how painful his high pressure, well paying job was all the time growing up. It made him really frustrated a lot of the time, and it really did cause him suffering. He is a wonderful, sweet, sensual man who likes to be climbing trees and trimming things, and he's an arborist really at heart. He likes to be in nature, and so for him to be trying to manage, you know, the grounds of a university was not what he wanted to do, sitting at a desk all day. And, you know, he followed that path and like did retire and went back to trimming trees. Like he did this as he was like 60, and he was like, I'm going to start climbing trees professionally again. And they were like excited to have him. I was like, you're insane to me. Like, you retired to trim trees again. But that's really what he likes, is to be in nature and in a tree. And so, you know, to see him come back into contact with that piece of himself and this job that he ultimately gave up to have a family. And so I think it felt really good for him to return to that piece of himself.
Right. How about your mom?
My mom, again, like she's reading these books on like the archetypes of the feminine, you know, that I get her, and she loves it. And she's become very psychologically oriented. She's extremely empathic, and like she's the chair of the English department right now.
Okay.
A lot of that ends up being interpersonal work to manage. There's this joke about academia, which is it's so petty because the stakes are so low, which I like that joke. My mom originally told it to me, but she spends a lot of time using her empathic attunement, which she's discovered, to like help the department stay connected.
That's remarkable, actually.
Yeah.
Because my experience with those kind of departments at universities can be quite contentious. There's a lot of big egos that are in competition with each other.
Totally. It is contentious. And she has learned a lot about managing conflict and like speaking her truth and all of these journeys that I think we both had to go on to be authentic. And yeah.
Do you guys ever talk about what things were like back when you were having trouble, and sort of, are they interested in, you know, getting a greater understanding of what you're going through and all of that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what we talk about now is a lot of, one way that I feel I've become an adult is that I spent a lot of time feeling really angry at them and blaming them a lot and kind of being in some in a little bit of victimhood, and there was some truth to like, oh, okay, maybe I would have had things. There's always things that happen in your childhood, but a big piece of coming to terms with my adulthood has been like retracting some of that blame from them and looking at what I did, because they put up with a fair amount from me when I was in my addiction. And so the things that we talk about now that are really emotive, like intense for me emotionally, is to hear what it was like for them when they were like, yeah, we would walk into your room and like not be sure if you were still alive or if you had OD'd in the night. And, wow. You know, hearing that from my parents is really intense. And,
oh, I bet.
You know, I was depressed at the time and that for sure had an impact on it, but there's also, you know, I have to take responsibility for what I did. And then they were very kind to me during a hard time, which again, not all parents offer that. So,
yeah. You know, one of the things I've noticed in people that are very empathic like yourself is that for beginning of your life, without even being consciously aware of it, you start to absorb the pain in the family.
Yeah.
And the reason that you do that is out of love and a need for safety.
Yes.
And then anxiety starts coming into the picture, because no matter how hard you try as a kid, you're doomed to fail because you can't take enough pain into your body to save them from themselves. But how would you ever know that? It's impossible to know. Yeah. So you start your life feeling like you're a failure. And I don't think that most people really realize how deep that feeling of failure is, because you did fail. I mean, and most people don't feel that kind of failure as a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old or even a 10-year-old. But when you're in charge of pain management, and you experience that kind of failure, you blame yourself and you hate yourself for being inadequate. And that starts to certainly impact the way you feel about yourself. And I think it's really important for people to understand that that the failure is real. Mm-hmm. And that feeling that goes along with failure is one of self-hate and self-loathing, because the failure is real. And, you know, people might say, well, you know, it's not that big of a deal or whatever. But for you or any of us that were super empathic, it feels like the house is on fire and everybody around you is saying, yeah, it's a little warm in here, but come on, man, it's not that big of a deal. And you're like, shit, the house is on fire. What the, you know, and they're looking at you like you're nuts because they're not experiencing the fire.
Yeah.
And most of the big time is because you've absorbed enough of their pain so that they're not even aware that, you know, things are really, really difficult.
Yeah.
And then you start to bend yourself into a shape to try to please them on top of everything else so that you can feel like part of the family. And the next thing you know, you feel like a failure and you've completely lost touch with who you are as a person.
Yeah.
And I can't even tell you how many people I've met in your situation that not everybody becomes suicidal, but certainly gets to the point where life doesn't really feel like it's worth living.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the family members look at you like you're the problem,
right?
Because you do develop symptoms as a result of absorbing that pain. Yeah. And so, you know, mostly we focus on symptoms, right? That's the culture we live in. So not only are you suffering with loneliness and disconnection, now you're the problem.
Mm.
So it's hard to feel like life is worth living sometimes when it gets that severe. That's what it felt like when I met you, that you were in that kind of a jam and you didn't even realize what you were carrying inside your body, because it was so normal for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember you had a girlfriend at the time that you really cared about, and your relationship with her was to try to save her from herself, which is what happens when you are brought up with that template that love is rescuing puppies by the road and trying to rehabilitate them. And you don't even know you're doing it. Again, there's no accusation in what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's just that no matter how hard you try, even with your girlfriend, you couldn't save her from herself. And then she would start to get upset that she felt like you were trying to control her in some way when you were really just trying to help her. And that just increases that feeling of alienation and loneliness. So again, I think all these things are important for people to understand, because, you know, you didn't become suicidal for no reason.
Yeah.
There was deep pain inside of you, and it was real. And it's not because there was something, in quotes, wrong with you. It's not because you were mentally ill. It's because you were attempting to live the life you were born to live, but in a desperate way, because you didn't know any better as a kid.
Yeah.
And your family didn't understand either, and most families don't. Right.
Yeah.
I see the same thing over and over again when an empath arrives in my office and describes a lifetime of anxiety and compulsive behavior and sometimes, you know, drugs and alcohol and all of that stuff. And, you know, you end up looking at yourself and thinking, guy, what's wrong with me? And what's wrong with you is really that you tried to do something that was humanly impossible. But how could you know that as a kid?
Yeah.
It's not possible.
Yeah.
So part of the healing process is learning to forgive yourself, actually, for taking on a task that was humanly impossible because you didn't know any better.
Yeah.
And allowing yourself to recognize the failure is real, but it's not your failure.
Yeah.
It's really the failure of the family to understand that they were not taking responsibility for their pain.
Yeah.
And that as an empath, you're going to do everything you can. It's like being the guy at the end of the circus performance who's walking around with a broom cleaning up all the mess, you know, and you spend every day cleaning up the mess. It's not a very enviable position to be in. Does any of this make sense when I describe it this way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad to be in talking to you again because you have such amazing insight and the combination of the sense of like failure internally and then also... Yeah, I'm trying to remember the, but anyway, that sense of failure for sure sticks with me of like, I still very much pride myself on being intelligent and I do have a little bit of perfectionism and things like that. And right. So it very much does feel like I wish to do the absolute best I can to the point of it being unreasonable expectations on myself for sure. And you know, one of the most interesting things that I've heard about being an empath. I met somebody in Hawaii, this masseuse who had also done some training of like emotional work or becoming a therapist. And she said, ultimately, what I've learned about being an empath is that it means that you can't regulate yourself. You can't regulate your own nervous system in the presence of other people's emotions.
Right.
And so what I really had to spend a lot of time working on was like not being porous and choosing myself regularly.
Okay.
That phrasing doesn't quite sound right, but what I mean is like I was in a very loving community where I could, people would say, how do you feel about X? And it was perfectly acceptable for me to close my eyes and put two hands over my heart and think for 5, 10, 15 seconds because my truth was so far away from my ability to vocalize it at that point because I was so used to just being like, oh, whatever, you know, and trying to downplay my own needs. And that's something that I learned from people in my family of like suppress your own needs and go with whatever will work either, you know, professionally or socially or whatever. And I do think it's likely that, you know, I would say one of my primary motivations in the world is to create intimacy. And so I think that motivation drove me to want always for there to be intimacy in my family. And when not feeling like there was as much intimacy as I would have wanted to feel really loved, I think I spent a lot of time trying to create that out of people. And, you know, there are many different ways to think about that in the world of therapy. But for sure, I still notice that coming up of like feeling really threatened when I can't create intimacy with somebody who I want to build a close connection with and that sort of thing. And yeah, I do think there was some, you know, some sense as a child of like, oh, there's a failure here.
You decided to become a therapist.
Yeah.
What made you choose the school that you decided to go to? Because there are many, and we live in a community with like 4 or 5 graduate schools, which is kind of unusual for a city of this size, that there would be so much education available for people to become therapists. But you chose probably the most, maybe interesting is, I'm not sure if that's the right adjective, but it's different than most.
Yeah. Pacifica Graduate Institute focuses on depth psychology and, you know, is heavily influenced by Jung, which, Dana, you are a Jungian analyst, right?
Not necessarily. No, okay. I mean, when I was in school, I studied all of that stuff.
But, yeah. Yeah.
I don't really see myself as ascribing to any particular philosophy.
Yeah, that's.
But people have said to me, you know, you got a lot in common with that philosophy, I guess.
I think there's some there. Yeah, for sure. Okay, yeah. My therapist before I went to Hawaii, after I had gotten sober, gave me this book called King, Warrior, Lover, Magician. And it's about the archetypes of the masculine. And I think you know, masculinity is not always, for an empath, masculinity is something that very much has to be consciously created because I think the stereotypical masculine doesn't always feel totally correct to how I view myself. So this book was a really positive perspective on the masculine and helped me build this idea of self that felt really useful, you know, when looking at issues like codependence. Okay, what is the lover archetype in its healthy place, and all of these things. And so he gave me that book, and then I went to Hawaii, and there was somebody there who ran a workshop on embodying these masculine archetypes. And and they did it with the women. Did it was like split up by gender, which there's more conversations to be had around Jungian psychology and gender and sexuality and all these things. But this workshop was split into the men and the women, and then exploring these archetypes individually and then coming back together and demonstrating them through dance and things like that to a woman, and you know, demonstrating the warrior archetype between the men, and like, what does it look like to have a healthy warrior, you know, this energy in the some of the aggression that I certainly feel at times. We've talked about, you know, anger and that sort of thing. And there was this really powerful moment of like, the women were in the center of the circle demonstrating the wild woman archetype. And I guess part of that archetype is that it shouldn't be witnessed by a man. And so then the men formed a circle facing outwards and like not looking at the women, but in this like defensive stance. And the idea was that it was a redirection of aggression away from the feminine. And so some of the aggression we see in society today may be a misdirection of this like aggressive warrior archetypal energy towards the feminine, when it could be pointed away from them to protect them, was kind of the idea. And it just really stuck with me. And so, you know, someone told me about Pacifica, and when they told me about that, I looked into it a little bit, and it felt really right. I've always loved stories and mythology and writing, and a big part of what I did in my undergraduate degree was like writing a lot of nonfiction about my experiences and trying to come to terms with wishing death on oneself and, you know, depression and all of these different experiences in life. And so I think I ultimately decided on Pacifica because it wants to go deep and into archetypal energy, and also because of its belief in story and narrative.
Are you satisfied so far?
I am. It's an amazing program, and the teachers are extremely skilled. The reading is fascinating, and it's stuff that other people aren't necessarily introduced to in some of their like master's programs. And it's done a really good job of helping me to go through my own journey. And like I asked, look, this program's a little more expensive than Antioch, which is another school here. What do you guys offer that's different? And they said, both are really amazing programs, but what we try to offer people is an experience and a journey within themselves.
So do you feel like that what they told you is true? That they are offering you an experience compared to just an education?
I know my experience of it is yes.
Okay.
And I don't know what everybody's experience of it is.
And of course, you can't know that. I'm just curious, right? Because one of the reasons that I'm doing a series on people studying to become mental health professionals is because I don't think that most people understand the different varieties of programs available, number one.
Yeah.
And that the program that you go to should be sort of mirror your connection to the world, because some people approach therapy as scientists and look at therapy as a medical practice, diagnosing, treatment planning, and, you know, having the recipe book in order to psychopathologize people and then how to help them. And then there are other programs that look at the process as more of an art, where you're dealing with a real person rather than a body or a mind.
Yeah.
Those programs are really different from each other.
Yeah.
Even though I know in California you have to be able to demonstrate to the state that you can diagnose and treatment plan and do all of that stuff.
Right.
That doesn't mean that you're ever going to do that in real life. I mean, I can tell you now, I've been in practice for probably, 35 years. And because I'm not involved in the insurance industry, I don't have to do any of that stuff. I don't have to diagnose anybody. Even if I had to make it up, you know, so that somebody could get insurance coverage, I just upped it out, 40 years ago, 35 years ago, because I feel that it's really detrimental to pathologize people. It doesn't help. So I think you chose the right program for yourself, because it sounds like you want to approach helping other people by developing an intimate relationship with them in a way where they feel heard and seen and cared for, which is so lacking in most people's lives. I'm sure you know that.
Yeah.
So is that part of what they're kind of trying to help you learn to feel comfortable with?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've done DBT therapy and it's amazing, and it helped me self-regulate and learn to regulate my, you know, emotions and all of these things right after I got into recovery and got sober. And this is some of the deeper work that once you are, you know, you can treat people with everything through this program, but it's also like once you've done the work of getting stable with DBT or CBT or whatever, this is like what makes life worth living, and to come into contact with some of the truer pieces of yourself. And truth is one of the things I seek in life. And to me, that feels very right. And yeah, the readings that they give us, like the thing that they hammer home at the end of the day is like the relationship is what really heals, you know. And you can look at, you can call it whatever you want, or look at developmental theory or whatever to say, explain why the relationship is what heals. But at the end of the day, it's having a person that cares about you, that teaches you to care about yourself. And they can offer you specific skills and ideas and experiences, but it is this process of like bonding with somebody and having a positive relationship that begins to change their life. And not only that, but having somebody who sees the world the way I did, because, you know, I had never heard of an empath until I talked to you. I had never heard of being sensitive and thinking about emotion in the way that you and I had talked about it. And so finding somebody who also moves through the world attuned to a different set of values is really powerful. And that's definitely something that they teach us there. You know, I'm in my spring quarter and they've just started showing me the DSM-5 for the first time. They really spend time before that on like, you have to do these practice dyads and just be with somebody, and they give you the skills relatively slowly so that you just spend a lot of time learning to listen.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and then they start to teach you the stuff you need to learn in order to pass the licensing
test. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, I know it's useful for that purpose, but it's kind of boring and
it is
semi-useless, but that's just my bias, obviously.
Yeah.
Do you have an idea? I know it's early in your training, but do you have an idea of what you want to do with your license?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I don't feel like I know for sure.
Okay.
But the things that I'm drawn to right now are, I do want to be in private practice at some point, and I probably want to work with some people who are in recovery, because that feels meaningful to help people who are in a similar place to a place I was in. And I feel like I have insight and skill in that area.
Right.
But I also just want to, yeah, I don't know, but I don't want it to just be recovery. I know that I love working in recovery, but I'm also hungry for some other experiences of really getting to know people, watching somebody grow up. You know, you helped me grow up. Other therapists have helped me grow up. The world of mental health clinicians have been so much more to me than just therapists, you know? And so I want to be able to be that mentor for somebody in a way.
It's quite satisfying. I can tell you from my experience that it feels really good.
Yeah.
That's why people say to me all the time, well, how come you're not retiring? And my idea is, well, why would I want to do that?
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
I know is weird in America, because you're supposed to live your whole professional life in the with the goal of retirement in mind.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't feel that need at this point. That's so good. What else do you think is important for the people that are listening to this show to hear about both your journey in your healing and also the chosen profession that you're going into?
I think, wow.
Two separate questions, obviously.
No, that's good. And I'm realizing that what I have to say is a little cheesy, and it's that things change, not only outside but inside, because when I first met you, I thought depression was forever and that was who I was somebody who was depressed. And then when I was in a drug addiction, I thought that was pretty cool because, like, you know, you need to have this, like, you have to have a psychological embrace of this thing, but I thought that was forever. And then I got into recovery and my life changed. And so I think the important thing to think about in the healing journey is kind of, you know, as you and I talked about, like, give it 6 months or more, because these things that feel permanent tend to shift, especially when you're working with a therapist and when you're doing work on yourself, looking for guidance or anything that will aim you in the direction that feels like the place you want to go to.
And what about for people, like when I first met you, what, 16 or 17 years old, and you did tell your parents, at least I think if I'm recalling correctly, that you were suffering and that you were really depressed. But their response was that, oh, you know, this is just kind of normal and you'll get over it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that, but I was kind of horrified by that notion because you didn't keep it a secret, but you weren't met with the kind of response that you needed to in order to get the help that you needed. Yeah. So if there are young people listening and they attempt to, you know, get their parents to take their mental health seriously and the parents don't understand.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what do you do in a situation like that? What would have helped you at that time? Because nobody was listening. It got to a point where you actually had to attempt to take your life in order to get the help that you needed.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is true. And like, I know that's something that weighed on my parents and weighs on my parents to this day, was that I told them and they probably feel like they didn't. They've mentioned to me at the time that they wish they had acted faster. And
right.
so,
right.
you know, but I think for a 16-year-old,
I know it's a hard question because how much power does a 16-year-old have?
I'm trying to think, like, what would you do? I mean, you could email. So depending on the parents, if it's an issue of like them not getting organized quickly enough and not knowing how to find the resources, you could independently find the resources and say, all you need to do is call this person and give them the insurance. So like, if that's an option, that's one pathway.
What about talking to a teacher or a counselor or even a friend's parents or someone Definitely. That might have really taken you more seriously?
100%. I mean, like my school had a psychologist. I didn't know it at the time, or I hadn't thought about it. And I would say definitely go to the school, go to the counselor, go to the teacher who you care about, tell them what's happening. Some, you know, a lot of people who are in roles for institutions are mandated to have education on the resources that are available via the institution. And so they can point you to some resources that you might not know about. One of the challenges for things like school psychologists is that how do you even get the word out there to the people who need it? And talking to somebody who you trust is always the best first step to build that connection and that release of the information that's weighing on you to somebody who you care about and can trust to help you. And then like, you can always Google like community mental health resources. There are, you know, suicide hotlines and things like that. And there's a lot more help out there and people who would wish to do what they could to help you if they could connect with you, is what I'll say.
Right. Great advice. So I'm wondering if there's anything else that you think is important.
What was the second question about Pacifica?
I'm just wondering if you feel like it's meeting your needs properly, but I think you did answer that question.
Good.
Awesome. A few minutes left, and I'm just wondering if anything else you might want to say just to encourage people that might need help.
Yeah. I mean, what I'll say is recovery meetings are super weird at first and like it seems like a cult, but it's filled with really good hearted people. I'm in a 12-step program.
Okay.
And so if you are struggling with substance issues, I remember being hung up on like, oh, there's a belief in God. It seems kind of like church and it's a bunch of old people sitting in a room and like not liking coffee or whatever. And some of that's true, but I go to a meeting filled with college students and that's really amazing. And, you know, there are all kinds of online meetings. There are LGBTQ+ meetings. There are really amazing, diverse resources. There are Buddhist recovery meetings. And such a big piece of addiction is the fear and the stigma. And what I would say is that I was afraid my life would end and I would sort of dead end. And what has actually happened is it has opened way up and become wide and full and beautiful. And I feel much better and it's worth it.
That's really very well said. Do you sponsor anybody in the 12-step program yourself?
I have. I've been a temporary sponsor a lot. But my role right now is a peer recovery. Well, actually, I was a peer recovery intern last year. This year, I'm the recovery program assistant manager.
What does that mean? I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah. So I'm still a peer because it's not clinical yet, but I hold office hours and talk to students and, you know, one thing I really like doing that feels really rewarding rather than directly sponsoring is doing all the kind of work that has to be done to process the AA experience outside. And so I like it when I'm talking to students or whoever, and they're coming to me saying, AA is weird. And like, I'm supposed to go talk to this old guy and tell him about all the shitty things I did. Like, that sounds awful. And so it's like, I get to do some of this work of like unfolding what it really means for you and how you get to make the program exactly what you want. And that feels really rewarding to kind of help scrape away some of the fear or the misconceptions and leave it open for them to have a sponsor that feels really right to them. And I do get to have conversations and be of service, but I think because I did therapy before I did, you know, recovery, those conversations feel them almost more drawing. Like they draw me towards them more so than pure sponsorship.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're bringing up a really good point for young people especially, which is that there are meetings at, like in places like the university for, not for old people, but for for people that you might actually be able to relate to who are not just going to roll their eyes or look at you like, you know, you're just a pup and you don't really know what you're talking about. Because I've heard a lot of people say the same thing that you have, which is they've tried meetings and felt like they just didn't fit in or it wasn't the right thing for them. But it sounds like you can find your tribe. In those situations, if you're willing to look hard enough.
Exactly. You know, there are young people's meetings in a bunch of different places. And it really is a thing where you find a place where you kind of like the people and you sit down until you've made some friends and you really do make friends and build community.
So one question I have for you is finding a therapist is not always easy. So how would you, as a beginning student in the world of, you know, becoming a therapist, advise people to find somebody? Do you have any ideas about that?
Honestly, something I heard from somebody who works at UCSB the other day was you write an email saying you're looking for a therapist to one therapist and BCC about 30 other therapists. So that's just like a couple of them might reach out and say, I have openings. And it's like, that's a good way to a little bit of energy reaching a lot of people, theoretically less energy than having to make 50 phone calls is that BCC. And, but yeah, as far as looking for a therapist, you know, what I would say is, again, if the relationship heals, while a beginning therapist might not be as talented, if you need a therapist and you can go to a community counseling center, and even a lot of those have wait lists right now, but even if they're not going to be the best therapist, they still might be able to listen, and that could be a big help. And yeah, I mean, it's tricky. Like, the university has resources, high schools have resources, but often having a reference is really important. And so even if, you know, your pediatrician or your general practitioner doctor can offer a reference, they might have some insight, or at least be able to connect you with some resources. But it really isn't easy right now. I know people who are reaching out, and, you know, at least here in Santa Barbara, everybody's booked up, and I know it's a national issue as well.
That is true. I you know, I feel badly all the time that I get phone calls and I have to put people off, sometimes permanently and other times for weeks at a time. So there is a very critical shortage of qualified, capable people. So again, another good reason why you cook is becoming a therapist, because there's a shortage, but there's also a shortage of people, especially people like you, who will approach helping people with compassion and love and the right ingredients. Again, Hugh, it's such a pleasure to see you after all years. And I really appreciate you coming on the show. And I think that people are going to get a lot out of what you've had to say. Any final words before we finish today?
Just thank you for having me. And, you know, you've the man I have become is very much you are a big piece of it. So.
Oh, you're so kind. Well, thanks again.
Thank you.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.